From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, April 28th, 2015. Hundreds of thousands of people are left homeless, and an estimated 10,000 are dead from Nepal's devastating earthquake. We'll hear from Oxfam about the latest situation. And Baltimore is racked by protests and police as the National Guard is called in. We'll get a report from former Black Panther leader turned reporter Marshall Eddie Conway. Plus, more than a score, the new uprising against high-stakes testing. Teacher, activist and writer Jesse Hagopian will detail the transformation of our public education system for part one of a two-part conversation. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Kumanyika, sitting in for Robert Jensen. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks for joining us. The Red Cross has warned that the humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen is reaching catastrophic proportions. The U.S.-Saudi war against Houthi rebels, who took over the Gulf Arab nation, has made it impossible for aid delivery to civilians by sea, and news reports indicate that land transport of aid is being held up by rebel groups. Red Cross spokeswoman Marie-Claire Feghali said, quote, "It's a catastrophe, a humanitarian catastrophe." Meanwhile, U.S. nuclear talks with Iranian leaders continue in New York this week. Secretary of State John Kerry has indicated that external concerns, such as Iran's role in northern Iraq in the fight against ISIS and its role in ostensibly supporting Houthis in Yemen, may arise during the talk. Now, Chenjerai, could there be mass starvation in Yemen as a result of this U.S.-Saudi war?
Absolutely. And this is really, you know, underscoring the importance of trying to find a political solution here. You know, it is indeed Houthis who are leading the rebellion, but there are a wide variety of parties who have been displaced by the transitional government and feel that this government has failed them. And so this is really should underscore the fact that the U.S. has to begin to deal with Yemen as more than kind of like a political chess piece. The U.S. has been happy to support military actions in Yemen for a long time. And of course, Saudi Arabia has tremendous motivation to sort of heighten and exaggerate the evidence that the, you know, to the extent to which Iran is actually involved in Yemen. We're not sure of that. They're clearly sympathetic. So I think to simply frame all Houthis and Iranians as dangerous enemies and then bomb the country into oblivion is not the solution here. We need a political solution and eventually humanitarian aid.
And Indonesia is on the verge of carrying out a mass execution this week. Nine people stand accused of various charges of drug trafficking. Indonesia's government, citing a tough war on drugs approach, has sentenced them to death by firing squad. Eight of the nine are foreign citizens, including people from Nigeria, the Philippines, Brazil, and Australia. Some of the convicts say they were offered lighter sentences in exchange for bribes by the judge. Indonesia's judicial system is notoriously corrupt. The planned executions have seriously strained diplomatic ties with foreign governments, some of whom send aid to Indonesia. The UN has also expressed condemnation. Already, ambulances carrying coffins have arrived at the island of Nusa Kambangan off of the coast of Java, where the prisoners are being held. The death sentences are scheduled for tomorrow morning. Earlier in the year, Indonesia executed five people on drug-related charges. Well, Chenjerai, the U.S. has historically allied with Indonesia. Earlier this year, there were plans to strengthen U.S.-Indonesia military ties, but President Obama has been pretty silent on this issue, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. And we can only wonder if that's because many of the countries who are already condemning Indonesia don't have spotless human rights records in and of themselves, Australia being a primary figure in that regard. Now, you know, but I think the main issue, despite that, is executing these prisoners really going to help the Indonesian drug problem in a significant or lasting way? And I think that, you know, there's people who have pointed to the fact that this solution is maybe politically convenient, and that maybe even in some respects, the idea of like a drug emergency in Indonesia has been exacerbated a little bit by kind of playing with statistics and figures. So, you know, I think it's a complex situation.
And finally, here in the United States, the trial of mass shooter James Holmes has begun this week with little fanfare. Holmes stands accused of fatally shooting 12 people and injuring 70 at a Colorado movie theater 3 years ago. He's pled not guilty on grounds of insanity. His defense is painting a picture of a conflicted man struggling with schizophrenia when the shooting occurred. But much more attention has been focused on the sentencing phase of the Dzhokhar Tsarnaev trial. The Boston Marathon bombing, for which Tsarnaev was found guilty on all counts, resulted in 3 dead and 264 injured. Tsarnaev is being painted as an unrepentant terrorist, and there's an ongoing media debate on whether he should receive the death penalty versus life in prison. Chandrai, do you see double standards in these two trials? A white man with a gun is not seen as a terrorist, whereas a Muslim immigrant with radical views is.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, time and time again, we see white Americans who murder many people being dealt with in, without really dealing with the political and racial context of their acts. And then when it's immigrants who have some any affiliation with Islam, the mental health context of their acts tend to be ignored. And this continues despite reports that the majority of terrorism in the United States has been executed by extreme white left-wing groups. This is not an argument, I think, for right. the death penalty at all. You know, I think the strongest case we have, you know, according to some polls, as many twice as many voters support the sentencing scenario to life in prison than those that support the death penalty. In addition, the Roman Catholic bishops of Massachusetts condemned the death penalty, basically using the argument that killing is wrong. We haven't seen the defense use those kind of arguments just yet, but yeah, I think there's definitely a double standard.
Chandrai, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Chandrai Kumanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University, sitting in for Robert Jensen. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Millions of Nepalese have been impacted by the magnitude 7.8 earthquake that hit the landlocked South Asian nation on Saturday. Initial estimates of the dead were 1,200, but that more than doubled to about 4,000 yesterday. Now, Nepal's Prime Minister Sushil Koirala has announced that the final death toll could reach 10,000. Bodies still remain trapped and rescue efforts are in full force. The earthquake triggered an avalanche on Mount Everest and tremors were felt in cities outside the country. Some remote villages as much as 70% are wiped out. Those living in homes made of heavy boulders were more likely to have suffered damage and death compared to those living in wooden structures. Hundreds of thousands of ordinary Nepalese are living on the streets either from fear of a major aftershock or from simply having lost their home. The public outpouring of financial support has begun, but funds need to be immediately mobilized to get help fast where needed. In countries as poor as Nepal, the aftermath of a natural disaster can be even more devastating than the actual event. My guest is Darius Teeter, Vice President of Programs at Oxfam. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. How important is the backdrop of poverty to the story of Nepal's earthquake? Would there have been possibly fewer deaths and less damage if the same magnitude earthquake had hit a wealthier country with better infrastructure?
It's absolutely true. The correlation between poverty and suffering and disasters is well documented. And just to give you some statistics to put this in perspective, 55% of Nepalese live below the poverty line. And a typical Nepali has 3 years of schooling compared to 13 in the United States. We enjoy 25 doctors for every 10,000 people in the United States. The comparative statistic in Nepal is only 2 doctors. We have reliable electricity, excellent transportation and communications links, and perhaps most importantly, we have a government present in almost every level of the country. And the Nepalese don't enjoy any of those luxuries, and that matters in terms of human life.
Now, is it true? I mentioned that the aftermath of a natural disaster in a very poor country can be even worse than the actual disaster itself. And I'm thinking of Haiti, for example, where the earthquake there, you saw the aftermath. Some estimates put even more people having died after the earthquake than during.
Yeah, it's tragically that's the case. Our number one concern in Nepal, you have tens of thousands of people who are afraid to return to their homes either because they're damaged or destroyed or because of aftershocks. And when you have that many people living out in the open, the number one risk is waterborne diseases like cholera and dysentery. So clean water and sanitation, basic shelter and food, that's the story for this week. And without those things, you get a second disaster, frankly.
Who are the most vulnerable in the aftermath of this crisis? Are you looking particularly at children?
It's women and children. Women and children bear the brunt of poverty, and so they bear the brunt of emergencies. This situation is exacerbated in Nepal because so many men migrate either out of Nepal or at least out of their villages in search of basic employment and work. So you have women who are already responsible for raising the children, maintaining the household, and feeding their families, now also alone, trying to respond and survive this emergency.
And so there are, I'm imagining, still rescue efforts taking place. Is it possible that there might be more lives that can be saved? Is it possible for people to have survived under the rubble still?
You know, we're approaching day four. It's becoming increasingly unlikely, but there's, you know, we've had situations in the past where people were pulled out of the rubble 5-6 days after a disaster. So we still hope and pray that more lives can be saved. We are in Oxfam, we're really focusing our effort on the next phase, which is making sure that people have clean water, food, and shelter. And we're injecting some cash into little tiny businesses so that the informal economy can be kickstarted and people can start to help themselves.
How is transportation of these supplies taking place when there's so much infrastructure damage? And there's still fear, I understand, of aftershocks.
So the logistics are incredibly difficult in Nepal, even without an earthquake. I've trekked all through this region, and you run into government officials on the path who are walking for 3 days just to do their monthly round where they provide some basic service. You know, they may be a judge or a doctor or a public health worker or a social worker. So even without an earthquake, it's a 4-day walk to half the country that they might want to serve from where they, you know, can park their truck. It's much, much worse now.
And so specifically, you mentioned a little bit of what Oxfam was doing. Specifically, you are trying to, in addition to kickstarting some local businesses with money, you're also trying to provide direct food and water aid, medicines, I'm guessing?
We've had an office in Nepal for almost 40 years. We have 75 people on the ground right now, and people arriving every day, more people and more equipment. Our focus right now is in these open air camps that I mentioned, where there's some 30,000 people living on, you know, in under tarps in the Kathmandu Valley. We're providing drinking water, basic sanitation, emergency food supplies, shelter, sanitation kits, and some cash, injecting some cash into the economy. That's our focus this week. We're also doing assessments in rural areas. And, you know, because we're a long-term organization, we have a long-term relationship in Nepal, we are really focused on helping local organizations and local communities because, frankly, they are the first responders, and they're the ones who are really understand the local context, understand the local culture. So our focus is very strongly in working with local communities.
And are you hopeful that there may be international aid also trickling in addition to members of the public in countries like the U.S. donating directly to Oxfam? Is there talk yet of government aid?
Yes, I think I understand the U.S. government made a substantial commitment and then increased it again yesterday. A lot of governments across the world, Europe, India, have committed assistance and personnel. So it's ramping up now. This is the tough couple of weeks because basic financial assistance is really crucial. It's actually more important than, you know, we're tempted to, you know, send clothing or send canned goods, but the logistics of delivering that kind of stuff is almost impossible. So the urgent need right now is basic financial, whatever modest contribution people can make.
And Darius, I'm so glad you brought that up, because our tendency, particularly here in the United States, in the aftermath of a disaster, is to look through our closets to see how we can donate our used clothes and shoes, et cetera. I'm sure it comes from a good place, but as you mentioned, the costs are prohibitive to even get it there in the first place. But isn't there, when people do donate money, the double impact of having the money trickle through the local economy?
That's absolutely right. People don't need what's in our closets, frankly. What they need is a little bit of, they need food and water right now to survive, and then they need a little bit of money to help restock their wares and get their businesses going. Most of Nepal is employed by the informal economy. These are entrepreneurial people. They know how to make business and how to take care of themselves and each other. They need a little help to get started. So we really try to focus on what they need to reestablish their lives and their income.
And then there are concerns, of course, when people do give money, that too much of that money trickles to salaries of CEOs and overhead costs. I know there were concerns around the International Red Cross, where there, was an expose of it some years ago. How do you make the case for donations to your organization?
Well, all of our financial data is absolutely transparent to the public. Organizations like Charity Navigator and the Better Business Bureau review our books, and they give us ratings on how we're doing. So we open ourselves up to third-party verification of all of our work, and all of that information is available on OxfamAmerica.org. So and most organizations are trying to do the same. So I encourage listeners to educate themselves and to look deeply into what they can find in the publicly available domain.
So Oxfam America is the website. Give that out again. Is that where people can make donations?
Oxfam America, one word, .org, and we have a relief and recovery fund specifically set up for Nepal, and it's the first thing you'll see when you go to the website. And the good thing about that fund is we use it for this very quick, urgent relief now, but we also allocate funding for the longer-term rebuilding of the economy and of people's livelihoods.
Well, Darius, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck in your work in Nepal.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest, Darius Teeter, is the Vice President of Programs at Oxfam. Again, that website, oxfamamerica.org. This is Uprising. When we come back, we'll go live to Baltimore. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Baltimore, Maryland was the scene of major protests and police response yesterday as hundreds of National Guardsmen were called in, hundreds of people were arrested, and 15 police officers are reportedly hospitalized for injuries. 144 cars were reportedly set on fire. News reports abound with stories of rioting and looting. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake dubbed protesters thugs. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, who has declared a state of emergency, is visiting Baltimore today. The protests came on the same day as the body of 25-year-old Freddie Gray was buried after a two-hour service that drew well-known activists and even White House officials. The young African-American man was in perfect health when he first encountered police over 2 weeks ago. After making eye contact with the police, he was arrested and subdued. Cell phone footage of him being dragged to a police car show him screaming in pain, his legs limp. Police say they put him in leg irons during the drive to the police station, and it was only when they arrived there did they decide to offer him medical attention. Gray died in the hospital a week later. Doctors found his neck vertebrae had been 80% severed. We go now live to Baltimore, where Marshall Eddie Conway is based. He's a former Black Panther Party leader in Baltimore, currently a reporter with the Real News Network. Welcome to Uprising, Marshall.
Hello, yeah. What did you say?
I said welcome to the program. You're joining us by phone today because I understand that it's not very easy to travel in and around the city. Can you tell us where, and you weren't able to get to your office to have our video stream, but what is the situation currently in Baltimore? How many National Guardsmen are there? As far as you know, has martial law actually been declared?
No, there's not. Martial law has not been declared. And I could get to my office. I just, all the equipment and everything is tied up because we're trying to cover this from all the angles. Mm. Traveling in Baltimore is relatively normal.
Okay.
There's a curfew for young people, and I think the schools are closed, but the young people are being allowed to go into church centers or rec centers, or I don't know how they're going to get to and from there, but that's the situation there. There's a rally being organized, or several rallies being organized for about 3 o'clock this afternoon. Okay.
So tell us what happened yesterday. How do you understand what took place? It's very difficult for us to interpret the mainstream media coverage, and all we've seen there is news of looting and cars being set on fire. But what is your assessment of what took place yesterday?
Well, I think what took place was the frustration of a community that's been impoverished, that's been without resources, that's been without recreation centers. I think the young people in the community is probably tired of the fact that almost 111 people in the state of Maryland been killed by the police. A large majority of them have been black. Almost 50% of them have been unarmed. And each time there's no response from the government, other than to maybe pay out some fines or some fees. And I think people are finally fed up. Young people are finally fed up. And they're acting out. But they're not just acting out in response to all of this stuff. They're also responding to the fact that they don't see any job opportunities in their future. They don't see a community that allows them to actually grow and live and enjoy life. What they see is a community that's massively policed, almost like police occupation. They do the broken window scenario in terms of policing the community. Any little violation will get you locked up. In addition to that, they're not even allowed to set out in some areas, and especially that area which is the center of this whole incident. They're not even allowed to set on their front steps where they live at. The police harass them and move them along. So all those things are factors. But what happened yesterday is kind of unique because apparently the police put out information that there was going to be a riot in one of the local West Baltimore shopping centers. They closed that shopping center down. Then they let out a high school, which, you know, might encompass like several hundred students. They let the high school out, and then they closed down public transportation. So the students were released from the school, but they could not get on the metro system, to go home or to leave the area. So they were stuck in the area, and then massive police presence pushed them down to an area in which eventually there was just incidents and a fire started and so on. So that initial fire was actually the result of letting students out but not allowing them to get on public transportation to go home, and then pushing them into that area away from the shopping center, in which they end up responding by pushing back.
Now, Eddie, can you tell us a little bit about the fact that the police in Baltimore, before the protests happened and the so-called riots took place, had issued a so-called credible threat against police? They said that they had information that black gangs were joining together to take police out. The Bloods and the Crips had made peace in order to take police out. In fact, this even trickled to Southern California, where our program is based, where the LAPD went on high alert. 6 people in South LA were arrested. But what do you make of this so-called credible threat that the police say is there out there for them to be worried about?
Well, I think that's always something that they will say so that they can create a certain level of fear in the public, so that they can target some of these street organizations, so that they... it would seem to me that if there was any kind of credible threat, there would have been some sort of an incident. There was no incident other than the incident that they created by pushing those young people around the city. So it's highly suspicious, but it also lends to the idea of fear and militarization of the police in the sense of, we should be allowed to do any and everything. We might even be able to attack those street organizations or gangs. Any information coming out of the city government should be suspect now, because they are trying to divert attention from the fact that it's been 10 days. And there's been no response at all about how Freddie Gray got murdered. There's been no...
And actually, Eddie, on that particular issue, even the news media are casting what happened to Freddie Gray as a huge mystery. The Washington Post said that he died of a, quote, mysterious spinal injury he suffered while in police custody. But why is it a mystery? He was in perfect health before he was arrested, and then his spine was severed after the police arrested him. Obviously, I mean, one can't sever one's own spine. He didn't inflict this on himself. So one can only deduce that the police somehow did this to him, whether intentionally or not, they did do it. It's no mystery, is it?
No, it's not a mystery. And eyewitnesses in the area said that one of the police dropped down on his neck with his knee. Mm. And that's what caused that injury. From that point on, he was limp. Even when they put him in the paddy wagon, the damage had already been done, and he was just really suffering at that point, and they had to actually drag him physically. Although he wasn't unconscious, but he was inoperable. So it's no mystery, but that's how they choose to frame the narrative, because they want to distract from what's going on. And I think the fact that they didn't... suspend anybody, or the suspension is suspension with pay, that's a paid vacation. They didn't take any kind of punitive action, and they were silently, I believe, waiting for this to go away. But it's not going to go away, because young people are really frustrated, and they're really angry, and they're tired of seeing people that their parents, and in some cases some of them, are paying to protect and serve them, continue to kill them.
Right. Now, Eddie, the protests were very, very spirited, and we are only, of course, seeing the sort of violent aspect of it in the news. The old tenet, if it bleeds, it leads, it has really dominated media. But I want to play for our audience an excerpt of what Baltimore sounded like and looked like yesterday. All night, all day, we will fight for Freddie Gray was one of the chants that was heard on the streets of Baltimore yesterday. Are you hopeful that this is a community that is really unwilling anymore to sit back and allow the course of law, allow federal investigators to come in? You know, people are constantly bringing up that that folks should let justice take its course. And yet, how long should people wait?
Well, I think probably what we're seeing is a shift, not just in Baltimore, because this incident in Baltimore, it's just representative of incidents that occur one every 28 hours, I believe, a black man, woman, or child is murdered by police or correctional officers or private security in America. So I think there's a sea change among young people that they need to call this system in question that's not working for them. The way in which their communities are being policed. So I think there will be a change because officials are being called to task. I think young people are starting to wake up and look at it. So I think we're looking at the beginning of a shift of a concern about how that community is going to work for young people. But I hope that shift carries over to the fact that young people need jobs, young people need opportunities, and young people need to be able to see a future.
Yeah. Now,
and, if we don't get that, we're going to have problems.
Marshall Eddie Conway is my guest. He is a former leader of the Black Panther Party in Baltimore. And Eddie, you have a very personal history with the criminal justice system. You were freed last year after spending 44 years in prison, and your conviction was overturned. You had been maintaining your innocence for years. So you have very intimate contact with the criminal justice system in the United States. And we're hearing this, the spark of why Freddie Gray was arrested in the first place, that when he made eye contact, when the police made eye contact with him, that he, you know, possibly feared for himself and ran. And given what you know about how our justice system, our criminal justice system, our law enforcement system works in the United States, is it surprising at all that somebody might run from the police?
No, it's not surprising. And in fact, the relationships in some areas, and in that particular area that Freddie Gray lived in, it's like young people are harassed from the time they are 10, 11, 12. They have constant encounters and conflicts with the police in that area, even moving them around, not allowing them to set out there, not allowing them to play, checking them, shaking them down, searching their pockets. And that harassment grows as they get older and older, and some of the same officers come in conflict with them. And the consequence is that if they see somebody that they know that's going to harass them, they might very well run, move out the area, et cetera, because that's the nature of the policing in that community. It's military occupation is what it amounts to. And it starts, it's almost like the Gaza or Palestine in terms of how the citizens in the most impoverished areas, and these areas are sometimes only 10 or 12 blocks from the inner harbor, where you can go down in the inner harbor and the policing is altogether different. It's officer friendly. So it's directly related to poverty, it's directly related to institutional racism, and it's directly related to protecting and serving the property of people that own the property.
Now, I'm wondering what your opinion is on what established organizations like the NAACP are, how they are responding to what's happening in Baltimore. There was a press conference yesterday where the local NAACP organization basically said that they want a federal law ending racial profiling. They want body cameras on all cops, and they want to change the way that police and communities view one another. Some have criticized this, saying that there's sort of a generational divide, that older groups like the NAACP have, you know, sat back on their heels for far too long, which is why we're in this situation, and so young people are rising up. What do you make of the of a perceived generational divide in the activism?
Well, I think it does exist. Mm-hmm. There are a new generation, but almost every generation has a conflict with the generation before it, what they did or did not do, or how they did it or did not do it. And if you go back and look at the civil rights era, you see Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference eventually got criticized by young people, including the Black Panthers, young activists, anti-war, et cetera, because they had a different idea of strategy and what needed to happen. That's true today, but the bottom line is that all of these groups contribute in some way, from some level. They represent a voice, and all the voices are saying, this is wrong. And so, and I try to encourage people to say, well, okay, that's the level they're speaking on. That's the audience they're speaking to. It might not be the same audience that young people are speaking to, but all the audiences need to be spoke to. And I think we need to encourage the, not that divide, but encourage some sort of a unity and have an umbrella in which people can work on all different levels, whether it's in the court system, whether it's in the General Assembly, or whether it's in the workplace or the street or the school or what have you. All hands need to be on deck.
And there's also a discussion in many communities about the fact that simply placing African-American, you know, leaders in positions of power doesn't make a difference. In the case of Baltimore, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is African-American. She referred to protesters as thugs. And there are others in law enforcement who are also African-American. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is absolutely true, because in most cases, those people that are put in those positions, they don't represent the interests of people down in the community. Those people that are given high offices or positions of leadership represent the ruling elite, or represent 10 or 20% of people that own and control the property or the wealth in this area or in other areas. So they speak on behalf of the people that own the ruling elite. Look, I have to go.
Yes, we understand. You're busy being a reporter. Yeah. Eddie, I want to thank you so much for your report today. And where can listeners watch or hear your reports online? Is there a website you can give out?
Yes, realnews.com.
That's realnews.com. Thank you so much, okay. Eddie Conway.
All right, I got to leave.
Thank you so much. Right. Marshall Eddie Conway. Marshall Eddie Conway is a former Black Panther Party leader in Baltimore, and he was actually imprisoned for 44 years and only released last year after years of maintaining his innocence. And he's currently a reporter with the Real News Network. Actually, that website is therealnews.com. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. 2 years ago, teachers at Garfield High School in Seattle, tired of seeing their students have precious teaching time stolen from them because of the hours of required standardized testing, decided they would revolt. They began refusing to administer the Measures of Academic Progress, or MAP, test. The revolt spread to a number of other schools, and eventually the teachers were told the test would not be a requirement of graduation. Thus began a new stage of organizing among teachers and students against the regime of high-stakes testing. Standardized tests have become a symptom of just how broken our public education system is. More specifically, they are the result of what happens when billionaires and politicians apply their warped understanding of what education is to a system that impacts millions of lives. Between President Bush's No Child Left Behind law and President Obama's Race to the Top initiative, students' test scores are being used to determine federal funding for schools and teacher tenures and pay. But students are more than a score, say a growing number of people, including my guest, Jesse Hagopian. He's the editor of More Than a Score, the new uprising against high-stakes testing. He teaches history and is a Black Student Union advisor at Garfield High School in Seattle, an associate editor of Rethinking Schools, a founding member of Social Equality Educators, winner of the 2013 Secondary School Teacher of the Year Award from the Academy of Education, Arts and Sciences. He's a contributing editor to Education and Capitalism, Struggles for Learning and Liberation, and 101 Changemakers, Rebels and Radicals Who Changed U.S. History. He writes regularly for Truthout, Common Dream, Socialist Worker, Black Agenda Report, and the Seattle Times op-ed page, and he now joins me. Welcome to Uprising. Welcome to Uprising, Jesse Hagopian.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Now, first, going back to 2013, when you and your fellow teachers began refusing to administer the MAP test that I mentioned, did you imagine that you would win even the sort of small victory that you did? I mean, of course, at that time, it was a huge victory.
No, that's right. We had no idea where it would lead, but we knew we couldn't go on the same path we had. We knew we were being asked to administer a test that wasn't even properly aligned to our curriculum. We knew we were being asked to administer an exam that was humiliating to our English language learners because it wasn't linguistically or culturally appropriate. We knew we were being asked to administer a computer-based exam in the MAP test that monopolized our libraries, where our computer labs are, for weeks at a time, three times a year, so that they became off limits for research or for checking out books. And we knew that this test was eroding the quality of education, and we couldn't be accomplice in that anymore. And we had to stand up and say no. And I'm proud to say that the Garfield faculty voted unanimously to refuse to administer this exam. And even though we were threatened with a 10-day suspension without pay, the teachers pressed on because of the solidarity and outpouring of support from around the country and really around the world, as thousands of letters of support came flooding into Garfield High School and signatures gathered from Japan to Australia to all over. And it was that support that kept us going, and the announcement that the MAP test would be canceled for high schools indefinitely at the end of the school year was a huge victory for us, and I think it signaled a new momentum in the struggle for authentic assessment.
And so it seemed as though it was also a moment that represented for teachers around the country that this this sort of testocracy, as you call it, in your book, that had imposed these high-stakes testing, is something that that people could just stand up and say, well, actually, we don't want to do it anymore, and we're just not going to do it anymore. And if enough people get together, stand together and say, we're not going to do it anymore, that it could actually happen. And that moment of realization was really powerful.
No, that's absolutely right. We realized through this struggle that the power of collective action is more powerful than all of their billions of dollars. The wealthiest people who have ever lived have formed this new testocracy, and they are using their billions of dollars, people like Bill Gates and Eli Broad, the Walmart family, the Walton Foundation, to reduce the intellectual process of teaching and learning, the emotional process of teaching and learning, to a single score that they then can use to punish students by denying them graduation, to punish teachers by tying their evaluations and their pay to these scores, and to punish whole schools where they label them failing. Rather than giving them the resources they need to be successful, they label them failing and shut them down, like we've seen in Chicago, where some 50 schools were closed last year with the stroke of a pen.
And speaking of Chicago, a year before the Seattle test revolt that you were involved in, there was a major teacher strike in Chicago. And you have a chapter in your book featuring Karen Lewis, a very prominent part of the labor teacher labor movement there. What was now that was ostensibly about the union contract negotiations, but it was also, I understand, about the larger issue of the fight for education reform and testing, right?
Absolutely. You've seen in school districts across the country, the teachers unions, the educator unions standing up and saying a big part of the struggle that we're in contract negotiations has to be to define pedagogy and teaching and learning beyond the narrow measure of a test score. The American Federation of Teachers conducted a study recently that showed that students are engaged in 110 hours on average of direct test prep time. And that's really robbing kids of the rich experience that school should be about. It should be about learning about a passion that the teacher has and a teacher being able to unlock the passion of students in their classroom. Education should be about unlocking kids' imaginations and creativity, helping them form collaborative relationships to solve problems, not about preparing for the next bubble test exam. And that's why I think teachers' unions have stood strong in this fight. And I think that from the testocracy's point of view, they benefit greatly from being able to define good teaching and learning as a single score. Because they want to narrow what the definition of knowledge is. If people are raised to be critical thinkers, they might begin to question the vast inequality that exists in our society today. When you have 85 people that have as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people on the planet, that is a dramatic situation of inequality. And when you have that many people who would stand to benefit from reorganizing the wealth in society, it's important to the testocracy to figure out ways to keep people from questioning, from acting collectively to change that situation. And I think part of that is defining wisdom as the ability to eliminate wrong answer choices rather than the ability to identify problems in your community and act collectively to solve that. And I think that's the real struggle that the educators, students, and parents are in across the country to redefine what education should be about.
Now, explain for our audience, Jesse, those who may not have kids or whose kids may not be in the public school system, just how many tests do kids have to take? How early do they have to start taking them? And does it depend on where you live, which state or school district you're in?
It absolutely depends on which state or which school district you're in. But I was in Chicago where I heard from a parent there who said their kindergartner takes 14 standardized tests a year. And what that means is every single week the kids are being prepared for the next exam from a testing corporation that doesn't know the children, doesn't know what's important to their community, and doesn't know what the passion or expertise of that educator is in the classroom. You know, my son just entered kindergarten this year, and although we scrapped the map for high school, they still administer the map test to kindergartners in Seattle, and so he'll be asked to take it. Now, of course, my son is well steeped in these issues of test resistance, and he is planning to join the movement and resist this test. But across the country, the proliferation of high-stakes testing is just breathtaking. If you haven't been in a school in a few years, you have no idea how many tests are being administered to our young people today.
So let's talk about the fact that teachers are organizing, but then so are parents to an extent. And actually, technically, again, depending on where you live, a parent might or might not have the right to opt out, opt their child out of taking a test. There was one parent who wrote an article on Slate about her experience trying to get her child, her kids opted out of taking a test. And she was hounded by school administrators constantly to have her kids take the test because school funding is based on every kid taking the test or at least having 95% compliance. But if more and more students opt out, then the school might lose federal funding. You point out in your book a story of a kid who was in the hospital getting very serious treatment and a school administrator going to the hospital with a test for that kid to take, and it was only the parent who ended up stopping that test from being given to their sick child. Why are school administrators so desperate to have as many people as possible take these tests?
Well, there's been threats from on high, from the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, on down to state and district leaders, issued to parents, trying to scare them into taking these tests, is trying to scare them into making sure their students take these tests. And I think that when you have to resort to scare tactics in order to strong arm parents into making their kids take these tests, then you know that this isn't good educational practice. You know you haven't convinced people of the necessity. You've only used these strong-arm tactics. And I think that their threat of taking away federal funding is really an empty threat, because we are seeing the largest rebellion in U.S. history against these high-stakes tests. And most prominent are the parents of New York State. In New York State, last year there was some 60,000 parents that opted out, and this year the total has reached over 180,000 parents who have opted their kids out of the tests in New York State alone. And that is so many students that over a quarter of schools have not met that 95% tested threshold. And yet no federal funding has been pulled from those schools, because when you have that many people participating, they can't punish everybody. And in fact, we see that it's an empty threat meant to scare people into taking flawed exams.
In fact, even in New Jersey, there's been a growing revolt among parents, high number of parents opting their kids out of the so-called PARC test. PARC stands for the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. There was one mother in New Jersey named Sarah Blaine who challenged Governor Chris Christie's task force on the Common Core curriculum to take the PARC test themselves, and that test has been shown to be very flawed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the parent uprising is breathtaking. Here in my own city, we have the largest number of opt-outs in Seattle's history. At my high school, we were being asked now to give the new Common Core test called SBAC. It's the other one of the Common Core tests. And teachers at my school were debating, should we go through with this? This test had many of the same flaws that the MAP test did, and we knew a lot of people around the country wanted to know what we thought of this exam and were we going to stand up against it. And as we amazing occurrence happened, which was that opt-out letters began flooding into Garfield High School by the hundreds, so many that we were no longer asked to administer the test because there weren't enough kids to take it. And our colleagues at Nathan Hale High School up north in Seattle actually began this movement and had just reported this week that 100% of 11th graders taking the new SBAC tests opted out. And so we're seeing in city after city, parents refusing to allow their students to take it, students walking out, and teachers refusing to administer it. And it's an amazing new civil rights movement in this country.
Jesse, how new is this opposition? I mean, this level of opting out, is this something that's just happened in the past couple of years?
Well, it is at an unprecedented level today in terms of the many hundreds of thousands of families choosing more authentic forms of assessment rather than these high-stakes standardized tests that have become a multi-billion dollar industry in the wake of the No Child Left Behind Act, Race to the Top, and now the new Common Core State Standard initiatives. But I think it's important to understand that this movement stands on the shoulder of giants. For many years, there have been courageous teachers and parents that have opted out in smaller numbers. But if you go back to the beginning of when standardized testing first entered the public schools, I think it is a really important history to uncover. Because in fact, standardized tests entered the public schools in the early 1900s as a product of the eugenics movement, an openly white supremacist racist ideology that was invented in order to quote unquote scientifically demonstrate white superiority. And in fact, Carl Brigham, who was a Princeton University professor and one of the authors of the most celebrated book in eugenics, also developed the SAT exam. And so it should be no wonder that it was black intellectuals and radicals, people like W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the founders of the NAACP. Du Bois was an outspoken critic of these new standardized tests, and many of his colleagues and contemporaries at the time explained how what these tests really measured was your access to resources, not your intellect. And I think that researchers have shown to this day that what these tests measure most is your zip code, right? The wealth in your neighborhood, the wealth of your family, the number of books in your home, the amount of time the parents have with the students, not the students' intelligence.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought up that history. It's really interesting because, of course, the folks, the testocracy, as you call them, who are pushing this, the Waltons, with the collaboration of politicians like Arne Duncan, have set up a system, it seems, that by which they can measure the failure of schools. And then, of course, that becomes the beginning of the end of public education, and particularly teachers' unions, because if they can pull federal funding, they can then reallocate that to charter schools, to schools that fit better within the technocratically aligned model of, you know, ordinary people fitting into this worldview where they just become cogs in the wheel, where the global economy is run by 1% and the rest of us are unquestioning. I mean, it seems so there is a long arc here where they are sort of relying on schools failing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And it's the reduction of these schools to a test score that allows them to push through their agenda of privatization. You only have to look at New Orleans to find out what the testocracy's vision for the future of education is. Because in New Orleans, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, Arne Duncan said that Hurricane Katrina was the best thing that ever happened to the New Orleans public schools. And that horrific statement reveals his agenda, because what he...
And Jesse Hagopian is the editor of More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. This is part one of a two-part conversation. Tomorrow we'll hear part two. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Bus is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Joseph Stone is our technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprising with Sonali. Your subscription sustains our TV production costs. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Gohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.